incredible.
Absolutely.
All right. I think we're gonna take another music break with a very suitable song. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
I guess I planted some long ocean seed of a song went down inside me long ago. And now I can't remember when it was, but it joined up with the rest of them crows. It's such a little song, it don't compare with all your big ones you hear everywhere. But when it dawns, we're in the back of your mind. The big ones are made up by the little kind. Union song, union battle, all added up, what is all what we got now. Union song, union battle, all added up, what is all what we got now. I can't even start to look around me here without hearing this song. Seeing all of us first separated, heard apart and afraid, hungry for the union, so we kept on. Guess if you missed out on the fight for our union, you missed out on one awful big step. Oh, it's people too.
Решил построить для внуков, строил всю жизнь, но не достроил ее тот прадед наш, оставил нашему деду. Ждали мы этой лодки, не дождались. Большую наш отец решил достроить для внуков, строил всю жизнь. Мечтали, друг мой, тогда на лодке
мечтой пройти с тобой вокруг света, но мечты разлетелись. Наши мечты. Станет час такой, что ты проснешься с рассветом на корабле. И встанешь твердо на палубе лицом к океану жизни, и в тебе воплотятся наши мечты.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So there we had actually, two songs. One, of course, was from Billy Bragg and Wilco, and that, was, of course, was Union Song, once again a Woody Guthrie song, which originally was from the 1930s or 40s. I think he originally put that out. And, of course, we had Leonid Kitrook with a – that was like from a Moss film, Soviet film from the 1960s. Commemorating Russian victory in the Russian Civil War, and very optimistic song. Like, what they're actually singing about in that song, which of course is in Russian, is about, you know, how there were all kinds of, before the revolution, there were all kinds of like hopes and dreams in Russia, but they were all dashed because of the reactionary nature of society, and how after the revolution, you know, and then they kind of the metaphor that they used was a ship. You know, like our grandfather started building this ship, and he dreamed of circling the world in it, but his dreams were shattered. But now it's like, you know, later in the song, after the revolution happens, now it's like, okay, you know, my son, one day you will wake up on a ship and you will be circling the world in it. Be worthy, right, of our hopes and dreams, because they're all in you. They're all embodied in you. You know, and and the new world is here. You know, for all of humankind. You know, and that's like the last line of the song. Like, it's really moving stuff. Like, it really brings a tear to your eye, and it certainly brings a tear to my eye when you hear those things, because it's like that entire sentiment is lost on us today, right? Like, we live in a very, you know, for lack of a better term, a very negative kind of popular culture right now, you know, of course, I mean, you can see this even in all the zombie apocalypse video games and movies that you see these days. I mean, everybody kind of sees the world ending. Mm-hmm. They don't see a better world being realized. They see the world ending. You know, and amidst this, like, terrible catastrophe, whether that, you know, and whatever, however that manifests. And you don't see this kind of, you know, that kind of incredibly optimistic view of the future. And like, okay, maybe there would be sacrifices to get there, but it's doable. We can realize it. But like in the 1960s, that was very much there, you know, in the Soviet Union. And I think that's definitely something that's worth mentioning. It's worth talking about. Because, I mean, you know, what do we want? We obviously want a better future. You know, we want to build that. We want to believe that that's possible. And that's something, that's a place we really need to get to, right, in our own discourse. So, but you are listening to Back in the USSR, and I'm still here with Brendan Campisi. And, you know, we're talking about Al Szymanski's book, and we just finished talking about trade unions mm-hmm. in the Soviet Union, the kind of protections that they afforded to workers. And one of the things I wanted to ask you, just going forward from that, is, and maybe it's the same institutions, but, like, how did institutions protect and empower women in the Soviet Union? Like, in particular, like, you know, obviously the trade unions would, as workers, would protect them. But, you know, like, was there any specific kind of women's organizations?
Right. There were mass organizations of women in the Soviet Union. In the early period, like, in the 1920s, in the early period after the revolution, I believe there was something that was, like, almost a women's branch of the party.
Right.
It was kind of partly mm-hmm. between, like, a section of the party and a mass organization. And that organization did a lot of really, really radical work in the early period of the revolution.
And this was, like, Zinfandel or whatever.
Yes,
it was,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that was mm-hmm. that was it. And they did a lot of really, really radical work among sort of Russian women in the early period, especially, and not just Russian women, especially... a lot of radical work in the Central Asian regions of the country. Maybe we'll get a chance to talk about that. One thing, as far as sort of later on, one thing that kind of comes through in Szymanski's description of the situation of women in the USSR is that to a large extent, there was... lesser reliance on specific institutions to protect women than there was sort of an insistence on universality.
Okay.
Of, you know, provision of services, universality of rights, not just in theory but materially, that it was hoped. And the philosophy was, you know, if we ensure universality, then that will create, you know, equality between men and women. There were also... you know, affirmative measures that were taken, and there were very, very strong anti-discrimination laws, very strong laws against sexist discrimination, as well as the laws against, you know, national discrimination that existed in the Soviet Union that were much, much stronger and, you know, had much more material effect than, you know, similar laws in most capitalist countries. But yeah, generally, the philosophy was, you know, you ensure a certain level of certainly with regard to workplace conditions, you know, you ensure a certain level of universality of these social rights, mm-hmm. And that will, you know, that will eliminate these inequalities. There were, I should say, that's not entirely the case with the situation in the workplace. There were a number of specific protections, mostly in terms of working conditions and working hours, mm-hmm. that applied specifically to women. Unfortunately, I don't remember the numbers right now, but there were sort of very significant limits on the amount of hours that, you know, pregnant women up to a certain point when they were still working, or women with young children could work. You mentioned earlier there was very, very extensive maternity leave, but even for women in the Soviet Union with children up to a few years old, there were very significant allowances that they were given, and there were you know, there were significant efforts taken to make sure that women, and particularly women who were taking care of young children, were never overworked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that there were, like, major provisions taken that, like, they were moved to, like, you know, even they were still working, like not yet on maternity leave, you know, they were still like, okay, they were going to do lighter,
yeah,
like kind of work. You know, they weren't going to like stay, like if, especially if the job particularly like involved like heavy labor,
yeah,
like heavy lifting or whatnot.
And it's worth noting that compared to Western capitalist society at this time, far, far more women actually did work in heavy industry.
Yeah.
So these conditions, these provisions in terms of health and safety became sort of much more of a live issue.
Yeah, these are very important, right?
Than they were, you know, in Western society at, you know, at the time.
Yeah. You know, so these are very important things to understand, yeah, like about the nature of, yeah, I mean, so much of this understand, like, demands that you understand something about the material conditions,
yes,
like obviously in the Soviet Union, if you want to understand like, okay, what the nature of the workplace was and, you know, how women, you know, were in the workplace, how they're treated there, what sort of conditions they were facing and what they needed protection from, mm-hmm, the kind of that sort of thing. Yeah. I mean, this is not, obviously this is not like widely understood.
No.
You know, by any stretch of the imagination. Like this, and of course, this is another reason why probably people should read Szymanski's book, because he actually goes into this.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, there's even other books. I mean, another book that people might want to check out, of course, is Socialism Betrayed, which is, you know, an overview of. Not only does it offer like a in-depth analysis of how the Soviet Union collapsed in the end, it also like talks about the same kind of a lot of the labor conditions and what the Soviet Union actually had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before. It basically started its downward spiral, like, which didn't really happen until the late 1980s, right? Like after Szymanski writes this book, right? So I'm just seeing like where to take this. It seems we've covered like so much, right?
We have.
You know? Yeah. I actually think like, you know, that is probably, you know, I honestly think like that pretty much will do it. Like in terms of our conversation here, like we've just covered so much here. I almost like feel we should let the people, give them time to digest all this information.
Yeah, not, that might not be a bad idea.
Yeah. But thank you very much, Brendan. It's amazing to have you on the show as, you know, as always. You know, I think this was a very important subject to discuss. I mean, obviously, you know, this does not get talked about nearly enough.
Thanks a lot for bringing me here. I very much enjoyed doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, once again, we will do this again. And I think that this really speaks to, you know, just what socialism was all about in reality, not in the fantastical, insane world of Cold War myth,
mm-hmm,
which is what we're taught to believe. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU 93.3 FM. Just got tongue-tied for a little for a second there. That song right there was called Our Locomotive, and it was a song from the early 1930s in the Soviet Union, when, of course, the Soviet Union was developing at incredible speed, building all the infrastructure that a modern society really needs. And, whether that was like, power lines or tractor factories or like, transport infrastructure or what have you. And my friend Brendan actually made a very good point. Like, why are people excited? Why were songs written about this, this kind of thing? It seems almost like something we'd take for granted these days. But back then, of course, if you're producing tractors and you produce a tractor factory, that means you can feed more people. You have the infrastructure, you have like the machinery to run modern farms, and you can actually feed like tons and tons of people, and you can actually like, prevent starvation, which is kind of fundamental, especially to societies which have traditionally been impoverished, been downtrodden, been colonized. They understand like how important that kind of stuff is. Cuba certainly understands like how important that kind of stuff is today, and just about everywhere in the third world. I mean, this sort of thing is, crucial. Like, people really... you could see why people would definitely celebrate this kind of thing and write songs about, this is our locomotive, we're developing like, trains and like, transport infrastructure and all these things that, are going to make our lives better, going to improve like our standard of living and make it so that we can feed ourselves, defend ourselves, really empower ourselves, educate ourselves, and just generally have self-determination, and speaking of self-determination, the song before that was called She Runs, which is, it's an instrumental piece, but really is about, female empowerment, empowerment of women, which of course also like happened at that was also like a big part of what happened in the 1930s, in the Soviet Union. That was really where things took off at that time, for working people in general, but also for women. Women were able to empower themselves in very, very meaningful ways. And of course, this is what we've been talking about here today, So I think how I'm going to end the show is I'm going to play Michael Parenti's lecture from 1986, where he talks about a lot of these gains, which were won in the Soviet Union, and how what the response of the West in particular, he's talking predominantly about the United States, but even like about the British Empire and like these other countries, what their response to the Soviet Union was and how hostile it was and how they were trying to suppress the Soviet Union basically from the day it was created in 1917. And just, this is what led to the Cold War. This is what led to the invasion of the Soviet Union by like about 14 different armies in the Russian Civil War. This is what led to like economic blockade, international pariah status, like all these sorts of things. Of course, we see the same thing in places like Cuba, which have been under like blockade, for decades and decades and decades. Socialist countries have basically been under attack from their creation by the forces of imperialism. And of course, Michael Parenti is going to talk about why. Why is that the case? I know I've talked about it on the show like quite a few times why that is the case, but it's always worth listening to this particular lecture again. I've played it before, and I'm sure I'll play it again after this. But I'm going to play that now, so I'm just going to say goodnight right now. And before that, of course, I'm going to give a shout out to an event which is going to be happening next Saturday. It's going to start at 9 a.m. here on the University of Guelph campus. This, of course, is the summit against austerity, which OPERG and various other organizations are organizing in this city. And that's going to be starting at 9 a.m. Here on the campus. I believe it's McKinnon Room 117 is where it's going to start. But this is going to bring activists together from all over Ontario and beyond. And it's really something that really should try to be a part of. So I'm just going to put that out there. So anyone who's listening to this, I mean, this is on Facebook, this is on the internet. If you want to find out more, but I would definitely encourage you to be there. So with that, I'm going to sign off. So please stay tuned. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR and take care, brothers and sisters.
A no-growth capitalism, as some of our more naive ecologists have argued for, is a contradiction in terms. The reason you invest is to accumulate. And your accumulation of capital has no purpose or meaning unless you can mix it with labor to yet increase your wealth further. And of course, you use large sums of it for personal consumption and for political power and for control of your culture and for that wonderful, good, happy life. that you so like. As George Bush's wife said, we are millionaires, or we are not ashamed of it. We enjoy our wealth. And I thought, at last they say it. Finally they say it. Instead of the usual thing is, you know, how we rich suffer and we're misjudged, and it's just terrible being rich. I wondered who that man was creeping up like that. Okay. Can you hear me better now? Is it all right? That seems to be out of range, actually. This microphone has a mind of its own. All right. Now, that nature of expansion really affects the nature of... it's an important imperative, because it means capitalism also can never stay home. It goes abroad. If you ever saw the film Controlling Interest, there's a corporate president who says, those corporations that stayed regional in New England years ago and decided not to go national, we can't even remember their names. They died. We had to go national. And those of us who are now national know we have to go international. We have to invest abroad. So one of the laws of capitalist motion and development is this inexorable expansion. And that means expansion into an expropriation of the third world. A process that's been going on for about 400 years. Perpetrated by the Portuguese, the Spaniards, the Dutch, the Belgians, the French, the English, and most recently, most successfully, most impressively, by the Americans. By the ruling classes of these countries, not by the ordinary people. The ordinary people simply paid the costs of empire. The ordinary people simply sent their sons off to die on the plains of India or in the jungles of the Congo or in Latin America, wherever else. But that expropriation of the third world has been going on for 400 years, brings us to another revelation, namely that the third world is not poor. You don't go to poor countries to make money. There are very few poor countries in this world. Most countries are rich. The Philippines are rich. Brazil is rich. Mexico is rich. Chile is rich. Only the people are poor. But there's billions to be made there, to be carved out and to be taken. There's been billions for 400 years. The capitalist European and North American powers have carved out and taken the timber, the flax, the hemp, the cocoa, the rum, the tin, the copper, the iron, the rubber, the bauxite, the slaves, and the cheap labor. They have taken out of these countries. These countries are not underdeveloped, they're overexploited. One of the countries that had a great deal of Western capital in it was Tsarist Russia. Mostly English, French, some German, some American, including one Herbert Hoover, who with Leslie Urquhart, famous British millionaire, owned the Russo-Asiatic Corporation, which if the Russian Revolution hadn't happened, Herbert Hoover would have been one of the richest men in the world. And years later, when he was President of the United States in 1931, when one-third of this country was unemployed, when people didn't have enough to eat, when people were driven to the edge of desperation, President Herbert Hoover said to the San Francisco Examiner, he said, my greatest ambition in life is to see the overthrow of Bolshevism in Russia. There came, with the Russian Revolution, a break in the fabric of international capitalist history. There now was a country where the unwashed, where the workers of Petrograd and Moscow were actually taking over, where they were actually taking over the land, the labor, the technology, and the resources of their country, where communists were coming in to power. And there's a remarkable correspondence between Secretary of State Lansing and President Woodrow Wilson, in which Lansing says, the Bolsheviks are wanting in political virtue. They would preach to the ordinary man that he might elevate himself through political means rather than by dint of hard work. This would be a most unfortunate example to the common man in our country and other countries. They understood what was the threat. The Americans themselves, the American ruling class, had very little cap, didn't have all that much. I told you about Hoover and a few other speculators, other people like that. But they joined in with 14 other nations to invade the Soviet Union, to overthrow the socialist government that had just been put in after the Tsar was overthrown. That process of invading a revolutionary country is still happening before our eyes. If you want to understand those years after the Russian Revolution, just look at what's going on in Nicaragua. Invasion, either by directly with troops from your own country, or by using surrogate troops, and they use the white armies and the white generals, the white guard armies. Embargoes, isolation, withholding food supplies, sabotage, encirclement, refusing diplomatic recognition. These are the methods that are used, and these are the methods, time-honored methods, that are being used right now by Reagan against another revolutionary government, which is Nicaragua. That process... This water has ice cubes in it that float right down your throat. That process of encirclement and destabilization continued right until World War II. On the eve of World War II, foreign minister of the Soviet Union named Litvinov went to... Did I pronounce his name correctly? No, I can't say it that way. Went to the Western powers and called for an alliance with England, the United States, and France against Nazi Germany. And that if the Germans attacked Czechoslovakia, they would all join in, or attack Poland, or attack anybody, that all the powers would join in to fight Hitler and contain him. The Western allies refused those overtures from the Soviet Union. Not because they were appeasers, not because they were simple and naive, quite the contrary, because they had a plan of their own, and that plan was Munich. And the plan was, we give Hitler Czechoslovakia and he goes east. And they were waiting for a war. And that war was supposed to come. And it was going to be Nazi Germany finishing off Bolshevik Russia. Just as they had sent armies in against Russia just a few years, less than a decade before, so they now plan to do the same. And so they've done again and again. And that war was fought, and most of it was fought on the Eastern Front. 7 out of every 10 German soldiers who died in that war died on the Eastern Front. The scale of fighting was enormous. The battles of Kursk, Stalingrad, the Battle of Berlin. There's nothing like it that happened in the Western theater, on the Western Front. In the Battle of Berlin, you saw 2 million German soldiers against 3.5 million attacking Soviet soldiers. The losses were stupendous. But at the end of that war, the Soviet Union emerged as a major power, very weakened, very much weakened, having lost most of its industries west of the Urals, having lost 20 million people. Most of its transportation, by the way, at that time was still by horse or oxen in most areas for most of its population, but it still had the Red Army. And yet it was not an army that had any intention of marching through Europe, although that was a NATO myth that was cultivated at the time. And there's an interesting set of documents that just came out in the American Historical Review which point out now that the West and the State Department never really believed that the Soviets were going to invade Western Europe. That was a myth which they consciously propagated. They knew that after an exhausting war, the last thing the Russian people would ever go for, or the Russian leaders themselves would ever go for, was another war. There was no sense, they had no interest in such a war. The war they fought against Germany was defensive, and they wanted to rebuild their country. That was a myth that was consciously propagated, that if we don't stop them, if we don't build NATO, if we don't double, triple, quadruple our defense forces, the Ruskies will be marching under the Arc de Triomphe. The point of all of what I've said so far is just to point out to you that the Cold War did not begin in 1947, but it began in 1917. That the Cold War has been going on even before the Russian Revolution, in the sense that the U.S. has been consciously, and other Western countries have been consciously, suppressing any kind of revolutionary forces. When Ronald Reagan says that we've got to stop the Sandinistas and overthrow them because they are an extension of Soviet power. We might ask ourselves, we've been in Nicaragua 11 times, and at least 5 of those times there was no Soviet Union. We've invaded Costa Rica, we've invaded Haiti, we've invaded Mexico, and there wasn't a Soviet Union. We invaded these countries long before there was a Soviet Union. It's not that they're surrogates of the USSR, but that they are developing revolutionary movements which will bring a competing social order, one that will use the land, the labor, the resources, technology, and capital in a different way for social need, communally, for non-profit public sector development, rather than for private capital accumulation. This would mean the death of capitalism, of that class with its power and privileges, with life as they love it and hold it, and will fight tooth and nail to defend it. As Mrs. Bush said, we enjoy our wealth. The U.S. Empire at the end of World War II replaced Britain. The Brits were eased out of Iran. British oil companies were replaced by American oil companies. British sugar companies in Honduras were eased out by American sugar companies. And America also picked up the tab. America built a basis, an American empire, over 2,000 bases around the world, including about 300 major ones. American fleets are on every ocean. American planes fly the skies over every continent, almost. And so we see enormous investment in the Third World, and with that enormous investment since World War II, an enormous growth in poverty. Now that's unusual, and that really goes against the accepted ideology, which is that attract investments in here because that'll bring prosperity and jobs, all that sort of thing. But what investment has brought to Haiti is the immiseration of the small Haitian farmers. What investment has brought in Latin America and most other countries has been the displacement of the peasantry, their proletarianization. They're being thrown into shanty towns to suffer poverty wages or chronic underemployment. What investment has brought with it also is increasing illiteracy, sickness, disease, poverty, and a dislocation and disfranchisement. A growing foreign debt and indebtedness. Growing investment for cash crops. By the way, that's what the whole Mexican Revolution was about. Was the land going to belong to the Mexicans so they could grow beans and alfalfa and feed their people? Or was the land going to belong to the big sugar companies and latifundio owners so they could grow sugar to export as a cash crop to make more money, to yet make more money, or coffee or whatever else? And with that growth, with that investment comes a dislocation in the structure of the Third World country, so that the whole infrastructure of it gets built around capital extraction. The economist Ray Brown, when he went to Cuba before the revolution, it was in 1958, he was there about a year or so before, was impressed by how every major road he saw went from a sugar plantation to a refinery to the seaport. While there were whole communities without roads, they couldn't get to doctors, they couldn't have schools, couldn't see a priest, the sugar companies had their roads. And when you send foreign aid to those countries, 9 out of 10 of those dollars goes to build the infrastructure to subsidize the capital investment of the private corporations, or to pay for the police and the army of that country, not to defend it from foreign invasion, because Uruguay is not going to invade Bolivia, because Taiwan isn't going to be invaded by the Philippines. But they need those big armies to defend their rulers from their own people, because those people are in such a state of immiseration. So that's where our foreign aid goes. And as someone once said, foreign aid is when the poor people, that's us, of a rich country, give money to the rich people of a poor country. And when Kenneth Boulding gets up and he says, an economist, and you can see when you get brilliant people like Kenneth Boulding speaking so naively, you can see the troubles you get into, the swamps you go into, the baby talk silliness you get into when you think without Marx, when you think without class analysis. And Kenneth Boulding says, one of America's leading economists, he says, empire is irrational because it costs more than what we get out of it. The British, it cost them more in India than what they got out of it. The American investment in the Philippines is only about $3.5 billion, but we had to give them about $6 billion in aid. It costs us more than what we get out of it. And that's when you think without a class analysis, because as we know, as you're going to know before the evening's over, that it's very profitable. Because the people who have the $3 billion investment aren't the same ones as the people who pay the $6 billion. As Thorsten Veblen said back in 1909, and Boulding should have read him even if he is a Marxist, as Veblen said, the wealth that's extracted from imperialism goes into the coffers of the select few, whereas the costs of empire are paid out of the common treasure of the people. And so it was with the British Empire in India. It was the Brits, the ordinary working people, who paid for the cost of empire. It was the Bank of England and the East India Trading Company that got the cream. And so with the Philippines, right? Of course, with a good skim to your collaborator, your comprador there. What he got just in shoes. For his wife. God knows his shoes were his girlfriends. Okay. Another resource in the third world that attracts capital investment. And you say to yourself, what is that mysterious resource? I'm looking at El Salvador, right? And I'm looking at the companies that are in El Salvador. And I look and I see Pillsbury, Procter & Gamble, U.S. Steel, Continental, ITT, Firestone, Ford. I'm saying to myself, wait a minute, what the hell's in El Salvador? A little sugar, bananas. What are all these companies doing there? What they're doing is they're manufacturing everything from energy rods to baking powder, from auto tires to computers. They're in El Salvador because of a very precious resource in El Salvador, which is the cheap labor, which is paying people 50 cents an hour. Instead of having to pay auto workers $15 an hour up here, you go down there and you pay them 15 cents or 50 cents an hour. That becomes a very attractive thing. And you go to South Korea. New York Times had a story about the South Korean farm girls who work in the textile companies. Companies that used to be in New England until they moved south. And then when the Southern workers unionized, they moved to South Korea, where there's a nice fascist little country where if the workers try to unionize, they get beaten up and thrown in jail or they get shot dead. And the Korean farm girls in those textile compounds are working for 18 cents an hour. 18 cents an hour for 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. No time off. And if you want a day off, you work a double shift if you want to go see your family again on the farm. And they live in compounds. That's the Industrial Revolution. That's 1870s. But that's big profit. And that's what they call capital investment, development, friendly nation, staunch ally, good relations, stabilization, stability. And General Motors, when they tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that they've got to pave over Detroit and they've got to close down factories because the cars aren't selling as well as they should, what they don't tell you is that in the last 10 years, General Motors has opened up a dozen new factories in other countries for the reasons I've just talked about. So here's another resource. This, in fact, is the key resource, the resource which is the source of wealth, along with natural resources, which is labor. Because one thing about labor, it's one of the commodities of production. It's the one commodity that does not use up its own value entirely in that process of production. It creates wealth. Now, there's another development, though, that's come with all of this. And that other development is that revolutionary movements have been emerging all around the world, these competing social orders. And so they must be targeted. Now, the United States has given a number of reasons for why, Ronald Reagan has, most vividly recently, for why we must go on with our military buildup and our intervention in third worlds, why we must attack countries like Nicaragua, why we must oppose guerrilla movements in El Salvador, why we must try to overthrow Afghanistan, Angola, Mozambique, Guinea-Bissau, and various other countries where the forces of social change are taking place. And the reason they give is the freedom of the people there for democracy. We are in Central America to defend democracy. Well, a moment's reflection would raise some serious questions about that hypothesis, because it becomes clear that, in fact, the U.S. government has a record in recent years of overthrowing democracies. In Chile, Salvador Allende, elected in a free and open election, was overthrown. 10,000 people were executed. Tens of thousands of others were driven into exile. Others have been put in prison, and you have one of the worst fascist dictatorships, all with the support of the United States, which after Allende's election cut off all aid except to the Chilean military. In Guatemala in 1954, the Arbenz government was instituted, and Arbenz legalized all student organizations. Students were very powerful. The first democratically elected governor, president of Guatemala. Arbenz legalized trade unions, opposition newspapers, and then he started doing some very dangerous things. He began to nationalize the unused land of United Fruit Company. And that's when U.S. corporations and the CIA went in and overthrew Arbenz. And that's a matter of public record, by the way. The CIA, the Eisenhower administration, admits that. Eisenhower proudly boasted of how the CIA overthrew Arbenz, because he was a serious leftist influence. And so with Mossadegh in Iran, so with Gulag in Brazil, so with Bosch in the Dominican Republic, so with a variety of other democratic leaders, at least six or seven in Latin America, who were overthrown and generals brought in with the aid and assistance of the U.S. government. So it can't be that we're there to foster democracy. We seem to also make war against democracies. And in addition, we support some of the worst dictators. If Reagan is really against tyranny, if he really hates tyranny, why doesn't he send freedom fighters into Paraguay or Chile or South Africa? Why doesn't he start sabotaging there, putting a squeeze on them? In fact, the whole fight with Libya might be less of a mystery if you understand that really the worst thing about Colonel Gaddafi, who is a kind of a strange guy in some ways, but not as strange as the media has made him out. He has called, you know, and you don't know this, most of you who laugh, he has called repeatedly for negotiations between him and Reagan, for peaceful negotiations, for peaceful settlement of all disputes. And the Reagan administration has repeatedly rebuffed those overtures. That isn't put in the press. I'm not blaming you for not knowing it. You're not going to read it in that rag that I saw out there, that Colorado thing that said, terrorist targets hit in Libya. He has done that, and he's done some other things which make him really dangerous. It's not the terrorism. It's not the attack on the Vienna and Berlin airports, for which they have no proof that Libya was involved, and which they have proof that the terrorists came out of Syria. The troublesome thing about Gaddafi is that when he took over in 1969, he took over a country that was like Saudi Arabia, a country of mass misery. A lot of rich oil that went into the pockets of a few rich. And when his colonel's revolution took over, they got rid of the rich. They took all their extra houses and gave them to the poor. They put out a land reform program. They put out a public free school program. They started a national health medical program, something that we Americans still don't have. The Libyans have it. He planted 40 million trees and started massive irrigation and ecological reclamation. These are some of the things that Gaddafi did, and that's a dangerous example to the Arab world. He took a bigger chunk of the oil revenues and reinvested them into the needs of his own people,
And the per capita earnings of the Libyan people are the highest in the Arab world, the highest in the third world. You didn't hear that in the media, did you? You didn't hear that on Dan Rather's Tonight. That's what's dangerous about Gaddafi. And the cue comes, and you know the cue, when Reagan says Gaddafi is a tyrant over his own people, like the Sandinistas are tyrants over their people, like Allende was a tyrant over the Chilean people. The minute they start social reforms, the minute they start tampering with our oil, our bananas, our sugar, our copper, our iron, our bauxite, why, they're tyrants. The second myth that's given to us is that these revolutionary governments are hostile to us. And that's why we oppose them. Right-wing dictatorships get along with us. They're friendly to us. Why is that, though? What is it about right-wing dictatorships that make them so friendly? What are they being so friendly about? What is the community of interest that they have? I'd already explained it, I believe. It's a common class interest. And the left-wing guys come in, but they're hostile to us. Well, that doesn't really seem to be true, though. The first thing these left-wing governments do when they come into power is ask for friendly diplomatic and economic relations with the U.S. Certainly that's what the Sandinistas did. They honored the debt that swindler Somoza ran up, and they asked for closer economic relations. That's what the Cubans want. Every socialist country, from a huge power like the Soviet Union, to a small power like Vietnam or Cuba, to a mini micro power like Grenada under the New Jewel Movement, every single one of them asked for more trade, normal political, economic, and diplomatic relations with the United States. Not necessarily out of love, but because they saw it in their self-interest, because their interest was to develop their own economies and to have peace and security on their borders, to invest less in military defense. There was even an article on that in the New York Times in which Fidel Castro makes that point. We want to spend less on our military defense. It doesn't make sense to the Cubans. Why must they go 16,000 miles away to Japan to buy school buses? That's where the Cubans get them. They go 16,000 miles away when they could buy them right from Florida, 90 miles away. Why must they get their medical supplies from China and Czechoslovakia when they could get them from the U.S.? Cuba has the largest import tonnage costs of any country in the world because of the U.S. blockade, a boycott. So it's very much in their interest to cultivate friendlier relations. There's a substantive thing there, much firmer than love. No one's claiming they love us. And love, after all, you know, is a volatile emotion. It comes and goes. Much firmer than love is self-interest, and therefore the basis for some kind of normal relations with those countries. No, my friends, it's really the Reagan administration that runs with terror whenever there's a first sign of friendliness from a socialist or revolutionary country. Reagan, as Tom Wicker said, in regards to the Soviet Union, for instance, in armaments, Reagan will not take yes for an answer. The final reason given is that we must contain the red tide. You heard that March speech by Ronald Reagan, vintage stuff, where he talked about a red tide lapping our border if we allowed Nicaragua to sustain the kind of government that its people have chosen in free and open elections. If we allow that, our own security is at risk. And you can see that superpower 60,000-man army of the Sandinistas cutting a swath up through Guatemala, Mexico, Texas, right up here into the heartland, right into Boulder, Colorado, dancing with your daughter and your sister. Do we want that? I hear they're good dancers. The image of that tiny nation of 3 million being a threat to us, you know, reminds me of the Vietnam War. We used to hear that same stuff. We say, if we don't fight them in the jungles of Vietnam, we'll have to be fighting them on the shores of California. And Walter Lippmann said, the image of the Vietnamese getting into their little PT boats and coming across the Pacific and taking California is an insult to the U.S. Navy. it's very hard to convince the American people that they should send their sons, and maybe, who knows, someday even their daughters, to go fight and die in some jungle to make the world safe for United Fruit Company or Chase Manhattan or Procter & Gamble or ITT. So you say it's to stop the threat of that communist country. It's very hard to convince the American people that a tiny country like Nicaragua or Vietnam or El Salvador is a threat to U.S. security. So you say it's not Nicaragua. They are the puppets of the Cubans, who are the puppets of bum, 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 bum. The big red bear in the Kremlin. And yet again, as I just said, these countries continually want friendly overtures, continually want friendly relations, including the Soviet Union. What we hear also is that there's another pernicious element, and the thing we have to stop in these countries is a thing called communism, and that there are communists in these countries. It's time, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, it's time we ask, what's a communist? What does a communist do that is so dangerous? They would have us believe that communists merely hunger for power rather than wanting the power to end hunger. They would have us believe, the New York Times, let me refer to an editorial where they describe the undesirable and offensive Managua regime. By the way, these countries don't have governments, they have regimes. You see that in the newspapers all the time. We have government. And I said to myself, what is undesirable and offensive about Managua? Is it the land reform program, where they took all that massive land owned by those few rich compradors and gave it out to the people who were starved for land? Is it the farm co-ops that they're setting up? Is it the community industries and the public
Lena,
work programs?
Ira, Sveta,
Tanya,
Elliot,
Chantal,
Dico,
Oksana,
Simona,
Emma,
Jimmy,
Amara,
and we're the world's youth.
And you're